20-year-old visitor is recovering at Queens Medical Center after officials say she suffered serious burns and injuries to her leg and pelvis after a boulder fell on her lap while she was sitting on a tour boat. It's unclear if the vessel, Hotspot, one of two operated by Ocean Tours, violated the safety zone established by the U.S. Coast Guard. Officials tell us there was no law enforcement vessel in the area at the time. Officials said yesterday that they believe there were two violent explosions. The state says because the investigation is still in its early stages, it cannot say if the safety zone will be expanded. Jason Reduya, deputy chief of the state's enforcement division, says that will involve discussions between the various agencies involved once their investigations are complete. Tours are still operating, though officials continue to stress safety with the unpredictable eruptive activity.
Apparently there was some sort of volcanic explosive event that caused hot molten lava to be hurled upon the vessel, causing numerous injuries to the persons on board. Right now we do know that in excess of 20 people have been injured. One has been injured seriously, others are on a more minor scope. There is a multi-agency investigation occurring, which includes our partners at the U.S. Coast Guard, the Hawaii County Police Department, and the Division of Conservation and Resources Enforcement. The Division of Boating and Ocean Recreation has issued permits to, I believe, four vendors to operate within, to actually operate lava boat tours. Right now, the captain of the port safety zone is 300 meters, so they cannot come closer than 300 meters from the lava entry. The department encourages the public to follow all of the emergency rules that are in effect and all of the directions from the Civil Defense Agency, which basically means view lava at a very safe distance. Do not go into the restricted areas unless you have the proper authorization to do so. So really it is a very individual compliance thing where everybody needs to be responsible for their own safety and to follow all of the laws, regulations, and get the necessary approvals. There is no actual law enforcement presence that's out there, and that's why it's really dependent on the boat captains to make sure that they're operating within the scope of the captain of the port security zone or safety zone. We do know that what occurred is that hot molten lava rock was hurled upon the vessel. I'm sure we're gonna know more as the investigation progresses. So DLNR is enforcing state laws as it pertains to the state's nearshore waters. We are involved in enforcing the state's boating regulations. To be clear, the captain of the port's safety zone is a federal order issued by the captain of the port. The primary enforcement of it comes from the United States Coast Guard.
That was DLNR's Jason Reduya at a news conference yesterday afternoon. Last year, DLNR fined Lava Ocean Tours $15,000 for operating without a permit. It's not clear how many people on board the boat yesterday were residents or visitors. The Visitor Aloha Society of Hawaii says nine of the passengers on board took up the organization's offer for help. Staff on the Big Island and Oahu are helping those affected families.
Hello, I'm Bill Comerford, president of Kelly O'Neill's in O'Toole's Irish Pub.
There's a certain pride in knowing that you know, you're providing something cultural for the community, particularly when it matches what we do. That's just like heaven. You know, it's appropriate to us and it's appropriate to the cultural aspect of the whole islands, and it's appropriate to what we do in our bars. It's just a natural fit. I'm very happy to have it.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, battling for affordable housing on the Valley Isle. But first, your quiz.
Unihua, As many of you were through your list of summer blockbusters, we're trolling through some vintage movie titles, and we unearthed a 1957 United Artists flick entitled Voodoo Island. It was retitled as Silent Death and re-released in 1962. It was filmed on Kauai and stars Boris Karloff as renowned hoaxbuster Philip Knight. He sets out to debunk the notion that a voodoo curse has been put on an island resort project. But once he gets there, he discovers man-eating plants and a native tribe whose bizarre powers prove that voodoo is real. Well, eagle-eyed fans of the actor William Anderson caught on to the fact that this early zombie flick was his first feature film. And for today's backyard quiz, can you tell us Anderson's later stage name? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, this is Joey Manahan. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hawaii's affordable housing crisis is cited again and again as one of the state's most pressing problems. But when it comes down to actually creating or sustaining housing for low-income families, developers are often reluctant to jump in. A lawsuit filed by tenants of a Lahaina affordable housing project has become a bellwether case for the future of affordable housing in Hawaii. Victor Geminiani, an attorney with Lawyers for Equal Justice, is representing some of the plaintiffs, residents of Front Street Apartments in Lahaina, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Victor.
Good morning. Thanks
for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Let's set the stage here. How many units are we talking about? How many people are affected? What was their deal when they moved into this apartment complex?
Well, the apartments were built in about 2001, 2002, with about $15 million of tax credit, federal and state tax credit money. And to help financing the 142 units, the totality of the project. It has a neighborhood of about 300 plus tenants. They're all very low income. 50% of the units have to be rented for people at 60% or AMI and below. That's area median income. By the way, that
is area what?
Area median income.
Okay.
Determines eligibility. Mm-hmm. And that figure, by the way, is somewhere in the neighborhood of $45,000 for one person and about $55,000 for a family of four. So half of the apartments have to go to people eligible at that income level. The other half of the apartments, 70 units, have to go to people that are even in more low income. They're 50% of AMI or below. So they're primarily seniors, a lot of disabilities. A lot of people that are working two or three jobs trying to survive and really have no affordable housing in terms of options to relocate to once this property, if in fact it happens, goes private. And marketplace rents will be charged, and that'll be August of next year, 2019.
Well, what have they got now, and what are they paying now?
Well, they're paying prices that are set based upon the AMI, and right now the one bedroom is probably going for the neighborhood of $900. That one bedroom, I think, is being advertised now for about $1,800 when it turns over. Every time one of these units is vacated currently, they're turned over to marketplace. So slowly but surely, there are more marketplace units being rented. So most of the tenants are paying somewhere in the neighborhood of $800 to $1,200 for their apartments, and most of them are studios and one bedrooms. There's some two bedrooms, but not too many.
This reminds me, I don't know if this is an accurate parallel to rent control in New York, where developers wait for people to, you know, age out of apartments that are way inexpensive compared to what they could get.
Yeah. Basically, the owners have, after 15 years, having first promised back in 2000, 2001, when they got the benefits of the financing that I've discussed, including, by the way, tax breaks, real property tax breaks from the county to entice them to build the project and keep it affordable, they entered into an agreement to keep the place affordable for 51 years. That was the terms of the tax credits, although the IRS gave them the right. The IRS, Internal Revenue Code, is the one that controls over the process that the tax credits are given out and allow people to get out of the agreements they made if they so choose. That allows an opt-out in 15 years if certain things are done, but it have to be done very appropriately. So the bottom line is...
allows the developer to opt out of that commitment.
Exactly.
To keep it affordable.
So what happened is the owner, in after 15 years, opted out using that loophole. The financing agency in our state is the Hawaii Housing Finance and Development Corporation, HHFDC. They were responsible for trying to sell this property to someone that would keep it affordable. It was not sold after a year. And immediately after the year, the obligations to keep this place affordable evaporated. The conditions are that any tenant that's currently there has 3 more years of grace. And at the end of that 3-year period of time, the place goes marketplace. The other deal is that any vacancy that occurs during this period of time, and it's been 2 years now, we have 1 more year left to go, it becomes marketplace immediately. And I just want to stress, these are 142 units on Front Street. Anybody that knows about Lahaina, it's the middle of Lahaina. It's very valuable piece of property.
Sure.
Not worth a lot more than when it was originally acquired to build affordable housing.
Help me understand. Let me just get you to circle back to the IRS. Sound like a kind of a loophole that allowed them to renege or back out of this 50-year commitment. Explain that to me.
Well, the IRS, it's no longer an available loophole, by the way. It's been plugged. But the IRS regulation that created the financing mechanism for tax credits allowed an owner, after 15 years, to opt out of the process of having the property be regulated. But to do that, the financing agency, and again, here it's HHFDC, has to try to sell this property for a year to try to keep it affordable. For a variety of reasons, we contend that the opting out was illegal. They could not do it. There are a number of reasons. One of the reasons is that in 2001, when the property was originally built, the owner entered into a covenant that ran with the land that promised it would be kept affordable for 51 years. So they can't, at this point, opt out of an agreement they made with the covenant that runs with their land based upon an IRS right to opt out. Those are two separate
So your argument is that the covenant, the promise to the tenants that they would be okay for 51 years, that still holds.
Exactly. It was waived by HHFDC after the year attempt to sell, and we think that was inappropriate, illegal. No one knew that waiver was about to occur.
If you own a property on Front Street in Lahaina, this potentially could make you a lot of money. There's a very powerful incentive.
Tremendous.
And you know, if I'm coming from the place of a developer, to be charging less than $1,000 a month rent on Front Street in Lahaina is absurd.
I agree. Let me give you an extent of the profit that can be made. This property was appraised in 2015 by the owner for about $8.6 million. As they were going through the opt-out process, they had to appraise it. This property now, according to the owner and testimony that was submitted in court or in legislature over Senate Bill 2293, which was a bill to try to bail out Front Street Apartments, testified on two occasions in writing that the property now is valued at somewhere between $32 and $52 million. Because the property now is able to be converted to marketplace, which means the requirements that you were pointing out to keep it to low income would be evaporated. The owner can charge whatever they want. So the profit in 4 years has basically gone from $8.6 million, apparently, at least in the owner's eyes, to at least $32 million and maybe $52 million.
That's based on being able to charge whatever you
exactly,
want.
Exactly, because the restrictions on affordability have been removed. Theoretically, our lawsuit would say no.
I'm still having trouble understanding that removal that you described.
Well, the IRS allows it to happen, but also requires it be done in a certain way. because you want to maximize the opportunity for the property to remain affordable since you made this investment in the property by trying to find some nonprofit developer or owner or manager that would buy the property, potentially with support from the state and county, subsidized, to keep the rents low. So that's what the year is.
That's what the 1 year was
about.
That's
what the 1 year is for. Unfortunately, the property was not in a very transparent way up for sale. No one in the county knew about it. No one in the state knew about it that I know of, except HHFDC, and the tenants never knew about it until after the year it evaporated. So our another cause of action we have is that the process that the HHFDC was required to use to try to offer this property and maintain it as affordable was not done appropriately.
Is there somewhere in this, I would think there would be a provision that in the event of a sale, there would be a good faith effort to make that sale. That's seem to be arguing that there was not a good faith effort.
The core of an attempt to keep a property affordable is that there'll be a very good and aggressive, in our opinion, effort to advertise the availability of this property to make sure that the figures that are being used in the advertisement will be able to entice people in to actually have the negotiations and to go ahead and notify everybody that you can notify in the political process and certainly the tenants to see if the state and county can't come together and come up with some kind of agreement to buy. This property, by the way, just to tell you, it's a great deal. Even at, I think, an inflated price, because the contract price that the owner advertised it for was $15.6 million. Remember, the appraised value is $8.6 million. Complicated how it got to that figure, but the advertisement clearly didn't entice a lot of people in. On top of that, you couldn't build 142 units in Maui and Friend Street Apartments for $50 million. So for $15 million, it would have been a great deal for the county and state to come together and say, well, you know, we thought we had this preserved for the rest of our lives. We will buy it, and it will be preserved for the rest of our lives as affordable housing. So, and part of our lawsuit is directed at resetting the process. If, in fact, a judge feels that the process was not aggressive, was not transparent, was not within the good faith attempt to try to move this property into affordability for permanent times, there'll be a reset, i.e. another attempt to resell or opt out of this property, and therefore we'll have a year at least to get our act together to try to figure out how to really deal with the problem long term. It's not only preservation of housing for these 300 people. It's preservation of affordable housing on Maui for another 36 years.
Yeah, that's the question in my mind, Vic, is what does this tell you? If you're part of the effort to create more affordable housing for people who live in Hawaii, what does this case tell you?
Well, it tells you you should work at both ends. You ought to be trying to build as much affordable housing, and I can talk at length about the problems in Maui in terms of affordable housing with statistics, but you got to start building a much more affordable than housing we have. But at the same time, you ought to be preserving all of the affordable housing you currently have. Do everything you possibly can to maintain all of your affordable housing, so you're not building on one side but draining on the other side. So in my opinion, one of the major concentrations of the state should always be to explore really deeply any privatization or any movement towards taking affordable housing out of the normal relationships and shifting them over to private owners and private developers. It's a mistake.
I have a feeling we're going to be hearing more about this, but thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah, thank you.
Victor Geminiani is an attorney with Lawyers for Equal Justice, representing residents of Front Street Apartments in Lahaina. And you can learn more about the pending litigation on our conversation Facebook page.
HPR's Atherton Studio on the 21st. It's fresh arrangements of Bach, Piazzolla, and Liliuokalani, plus original work from the Eli 3.0. These are three alums of Yale School of Music and some of Hawaii's finest. Violinists Nancy Shoup Wu and Dwayne Padilla, and guitarist Ian O'Sullivan. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
The Alawai Canal, it's overdue for an overhaul. The flood control project is the subject of today's reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Anita Hofschneider is on the line with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So what's the snapshot? Where are we at with this project?
Well, just to give you some background, every year there's a 1% chance that there will be a catastrophic flood that would wipe out Waikiki. A lot of people don't realize that, but the Alawai Canal is expected to overflow. It's called the 1-in-100 years flood. And this is something that the state and the federal government have been preparing for and studying and trying to figure out how they could minimize the damage caused by such a big event.
You know, I recall going down there during the king tides, the highest high tide last summer, and was just amazed at how the waters were lapping at the edges. It was kind of a little scary.
Exactly. And it would be very destructive because, as you know, Waikiki is at the heart of Hawaii's tourism economy. And the engineers over at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers estimate that it would cost at least $1 billion to repair the potential damage from this flood, and that 3,000 structures could be damaged or affected.
Right. And the Army Corps of Engineers has a plan, a proposal to put up some walls to help kind of mitigate the floodwaters from going into Waikiki. Talk about that.
Exactly. Well, as part of the mitigation efforts, engineers have studied it and found that there's a need for flood walls along the Alawai Canal that would be an average of 4 feet high. So in some areas, they could be as low as 1 foot, but in other areas, as high as 6 feet. And that would essentially prevent the water from overflowing in the case of this flood.
Right. No, some folks might think, oh, my goodness, a 6-foot-high wall along the Alawai, that'd be pretty ugly. But it would serve a purpose.
Exactly. And what the engineers are saying is that this is not a question of if, it's a question of when. They know that this is going to happen. They just don't know when. And they really want to make sure that they're as prepared as possible to prevent significant damage. Which brings us to the story I wrote today, which was that Congress has actually appropriated a significant amount of money in order to make this project actually happen.
Right. And now the city and both the city and state are behind cleaning up the Alawai and doing what we need to do to prevent a flood.
Yes, the governor's supportive. The mayor is supportive. Their share will actually be more than $100 million. So they're going to have to really talk and figure out, you know, how much the city will cover, how much the state will cover, and how they will repay the federal government their share of the project.
Right. And we're talking about potentially a public-private partnership?
Yes, that's something that they're considering. The total cost of the project is $345 million, and Congress has appropriated that amount up front so that the project can get started right away. But there definitely will be a need for the city and state to repay about a third of that.
Right, so it'll be interesting to see what ideas they come up with, maybe some type of commercialism along the canal, which they have talked about for many years. But I know you folks have done a number of stories over the years about the history of the Alawai Canal, dating back to its time in Waikiki when they had to drain the swamp over there. So thanks a lot for joining us today. And folks can read your story today as well as all the past stories on civilbeat.org.
In yesterday's program, we focused on the issue of tourism, and everyone in the state is affected in some way. We asked you to share your thoughts, and this is what some of you had to say.
Hello, my name is Anne. I'm actually an evacuee from the Leilani Association. I had an Airbnb, and I just wanted to comment that sometimes I feel that we, as hosts for Airbnbs, take more of a connection with our visitors, our guests that come to stay with us, than if you were checking in at a hotel. The night of May 3rd, when we had the first eruption that happened in Leilani, I contacted the group that I know that are hosts and were able to get two young women that were staying in a unit in Leilani out within 2 hours and into a safe location. I take care of my guests as I do a family member. Aloha.
Hello, this is Carol Green from Kapoho calling. I just want to mention that tourism in Hawaii is very important. But when you allow tourism to override the considerations of the residents, then the residents leave and you have nobody to sweep the floor. You have nobody to make the bed in the hotel. You have nobody to cook the eggs in the morning for breakfast, and you will have no tourism. Thank you very much. Aloha.
Hi, this is Mike Beekler calling from Waialua on Oahu and enjoying the conversation today. And I just wanted to comment about State Rep. Richard Onishi's comments that they were trying to help the counties and the counties needed help with money for enforcement. And I think that's categorically wrong. All four counties' enforcement divisions supported the Senate bill 2999 that was going through last year. And they all came before the legislature and described their need for new enforcement mechanisms authorized by the state. Thank you very much. Aloha.
Thanks for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217.
A new operation called Hui Car Share is the latest example of a new business model that could shake up the car rental industry. It's a ride-sharing service managed from your smartphone through a free downloadable app. HPR reporter Kuvei Hiraishi came by our studio to tell us about it.
This car share that just opened up, Hui Car Share, it's a round-trip station-based car sharing service. So basically, you've got these stations with cars, a lot like the Biki Bike Share that's already rolled out.
But with cars.
Uh-huh. And so what you do is you sign up for the service on your smartphone, you download the app, and what you're able to do is open that app to check out which cars are available in your area.
Uh-huh.
And you can reserve it right on the spot if the car's available for something like $10 an hour, if you want it for longer for the whole day, reserve it. You go to the car, and the smartphone will actually connect through Bluetooth to the car. Open up the car, you get in, you take it out, and then when you get it back to the station, you do the same thing with the Bluetooth and disconnect. That's what it's doing. That's how this works.
It's kind of, it's unlikely to allow the rental car business to stay the same, I would think.
It's definitely going to disrupt the rental car business and a lot of the businesses. There's about 24 car sharing services nationwide, and a lot of them are from the traditional rental car companies because they've seen early on that we need to give a different product to folks who want to rent for perhaps less than a day and don't want to deal with us, don't want to deal with someone at a counter, don't want to deal with everything that goes into that. So everything included in the price is actually the gas and the insurance. So you don't have to figure that out on your own like you do with the traditional rental companies.
How do the prices compare?
The prices are pretty, it's pretty much the same as all the other ones on the mainland. So it's $9.95 for the hour or $79.95 for the day. And they're kind of looking to get into that market of folks who may be using other public transportation, but then want the flexibility once they get into the city to go do an errand for an hour during lunch, right? Or go grocery shopping. Maybe they use the bike all the time or bike share, and they want to go grocery shopping and put a bunch of stuff into their car. So that's the idea of the folks that they're trying to find. I think the number that I found from AAA for the cost of owning and operating a car on the for the year is about $8,500. And that's on the mainland, I think. That's an average across the nation. Here, it's probably going to be a little higher, given the price of gas. So if you look at those prices, it's much more cost effective, especially if you're not using the car all the time.
So if I want to go we're in downtown roughly, and I want to go to the North Shore, can I just take the car out there, ditch the car, and then once I've put the car in another locale, the meter is no longer running, I just pay for the time it took me to drive out there?
Exactly. And
then how do I get back?
And how
just
do you
do
get
the
back?
Same thing?
You do the same thing. It's your car for the time that you rent it. And they've actually got really smart about the local lifestyle. So they've got surf racks and they've got things on these cars to allow you to do exactly that. Have that recreational outlet if you don't have a car in town. You know, anybody who lives in town, parking is extremely expensive just to have a parking space, and some condo or some apartments don't even have one. So having the car option may be something that's attractive to them.
Where are these cars stashed? Do they have parking lots with cars?
Yes. So the difference about, or the thing about this one is what the Hui Car Share Company did was work with local landowners and private landowners and parking lot operators to try to get some of their spots to put their cars in. They've got 25 locations across the city, as far as Market City on the Kaimuki side, and then downtown Honolulu on this side. So a lot of options, 70 cars. They're thinking that, estimating that they will be able to serve about 10, maybe tens of thousands of people with those cars, and then possibly expand.
70 cars on Oahu.
70 cars on Oahu, and they're 25. Only in urban Honolulu.
And this is just one of the companies doing this.
Exactly, right? Yes. So the other company that I'm aware of is Enterprise Car Share, and they've been around for about, since 2012. They started over at UH, and a big hub for college students needing that car but not having, you know, not having a car themselves. So they started there and expanded to Honolulu and Waikiki. They have around the same prices. I recently looked at the their website the other day, and they actually dropped the price down a dollar or something like that to kind of compete, because these are really the only two companies that are out there that I'm aware of.
Is this just Oahu at this point?
It is just Oahu, and I think a big part of that is car sharing services have seen the most success in urban core areas where folks, it's more convenient and more cost effective to share a car than to own a car.
I would think one of the problems in terms of whether or not they're able to expand would be simply space. You know, parking space in a city.
Exactly, and that's actually one of the biggest challenges for car share companies. This particular model, where they have station-based technology, they don't need to rely on metered parking or street parking. But one of the issues is what other parking spaces can they take away from what's already there,
right,
to allow for car share? Kind of like what Bicky. When Vicky came out, a lot of folks got a little bit upset because they were taking, these stations had taken away two or three spaces on this crucial corner for folks who don't pay parking in their building.
Well, as with so many things on Oahu, space is the issue, right?
It is, and there's a specific ordinance in Honolulu City Council on the Honolulu City Ordinance that prohibits the use of these on-street parking, metered parking spaces for commercial entities. So there was another car sharing company that tried to get into the market in Hawaii back in 2015 called Car2Go. And they have a different business model, no stations. What they do is kind of what other car sharing companies do, a one-way type of thing. So you park it wherever, you lock it, and then somebody will go and pick it up. But there's no designated parking areas. And that's what they wanted to do, but the ordinance prohibited. So they actually pulled out. They had a whole office set up. They hired folks, and then they had to leave because it just didn't work for them. So hopefully we'll see some movement there.
Kuuve Hiraishi is HPR's General Assignment Reporter. You can find her full report on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki featuring ZipPass, an online tool to secure a place in line. AmazingUrgentCare.com. Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the simply massive universe around our very small planet, and also what we can look for in our dark island skies. And we're tapping into the expertise of Christopher Phillips, and so fortunate to have him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have in store this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be back. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn throughout the evening in the south and southeast after sunset. The moon this week is passing through its first quarter phase, which means stargazing conditions should be wonderful through to the end of the week.
Now, this week, you've got an update on a new observatory project, and this one is in a country that we don't often hear about these happening.
Yes, last week saw the inauguration of the Meerkat Radio Telescope in South Africa. Meerkat's 64-dish array marks a key stage in the development of the Square Kilometer Array, an even larger radio telescope. When it comes online in the 2020s, it will be the largest radio telescope in existence, with up to 3,000 dishes spread across South Africa and Australia.
And so what will Meerkat do in the meantime while we're waiting for SKA?
Well, the key science questions that Meerkat will address are those of galaxy formation and evolution and structure. It will also explore things like dark energy and examine the fundamental laws of nature that govern our universe, such as gravity.
And one of the things that's been a facet of some of your recent reports, Chris, has been sometimes they generate so much data with one project that they can't even really go through it all. And I'm just wondering, is that going to be an issue with this thing?
Yes, it's a huge challenge. And one of the main problems we have is sorting and processing the petabytes of data that this telescope will generate over its lifetime. Luckily, advances in big data and machine learning will help us deal with this data deluge, but it's still going to be fairly intense.
And Meerkat, now that's an adorable little creature. What about the name? I guess that's probably what I like the most about this whole story.
Well, the telescope was originally a lot smaller and just called the CAT, or Karoo Array Telescope. Since then, it has grown a little bit, and it's now called Meerkat, which actually means more of cat, not to be confused with Suricata suricata, the small mammal that lives in Karoo.
Well, I'm glad you straightened that out, because I'm sure that was going to confuse most people. We're always grateful for these kind of updates from you. It's Christopher Phillips and another fun Stargazer report. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for more Stargazer, which you can find on demand at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Earlier in the show, we told you that the film Voodoo Island was the first feature film that actor William Anderson appeared in. We wanted you to tell us his stage name. Well, holy hula dancers, the answer is Adam West. He was TV's first Batman in the 1960s. He had a bit part in the 1957 zombie flick re-released in 1962 under the title Silent Death. The film was filmed on Kauai, and West's role was Weather Station No. 4 radio operator. And this was before major Hollywood fame, so he didn't get his name in the credits. Born in 1928, Seattle native West served in the Army and landed a job in Honolulu as KGMB Radio's newsman Bill Anderson. He also worked on KGMB's TV's Kini Popo show. Kini was actually fellow KGMB radio personality Carl Hebenstreet. Well, it was while working as an island tour guide that he impressed a vacationing Hollywood agent who invited him to screen test for Warner Brothers Studios. And the rest, as they say, is Cape Crusader history.
And Catherine Frank Asante of Kaheka somehow knew the answer to that. Congratulations. You're our winner, and that's our quiz for today. If you've got one, just send us a bat signal or send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Tim Delaney, president of the National Council of Nonprofits, and you're listening to The Conversation, a member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Like an endless wave, there are countless books published about surfing. Hawaiians are credited for creating the sport, and a new book went to Hawaiian language newspapers as a resource as it traced surfing's history in the islands. on a trip to France. We caught up with Jeremy Lamourier, whose just published book was featured at the Hawaii Festival in Paris. Lamourier, who studied history, sociology, and cultural anthropology, taught at the University of Hawaii, where his thesis looked at the history of surfing from sources that hadn't been tapped before, Hawaiian and French sources. Lamourier provides an interesting snapshot back to when the French first came to explore Hawaii's shores.
So my research is basically learning about how he'enaru, which is a traditional form of surfing in Hawaii, turned into modern sport, into what surfing is today, a global sport having about 25 million of people. And I ended up being interested in the traditional Hawaiian aspect of it. Now many people are doing that already. Some, I can quote Patrick Moser, for instance. Also, there is Isaiah Walker. They are very famous surf historian. And as I would study this topic for my PhD dissertation, I discovered that huge database called Papakilo Database. Actually, the database has numerized or digitalized most Hawaiian newspapers. And what is interesting is these newspapers is there's another history. The history of Hawaii mostly have been written by English scholars from English sources. But now there's a, through surfing, partly another movement, there is the idea that the Hawaiian history should be rewritten from the Hawaiian point of view. So when I started my PhD, I was first learning this history from English sources, also from French sources, because the French wrote about Hawaiian history and went to Hawaii and have a very valuable input that can first have another angle at the history. And on top of that, if you can read Hawaiian, you end up having the native point of view. And the native point of view regarding surfing is that unlike most English sources says, it never died out, or it never really what was in so-called dark age. It was still not as big as before contact with the West, but surfing was still alive and practiced by many Hawaiians, and also by what they call the Kama'ainas, which were Westerners living in the island for a long period of time, also descendant of missionaries who were born and raised in Hawaii, but were having white blood.
What French sources did you tap when you were doing your research? Are you talking the French explorers that first came, like Freycinet?
Yeah, there is French explorers, like Freycinet indeed, but also there were merchants. Many merchants came, and it's interesting to see, so there was merchants, explorers, and later also the first tourists, the first visitors to Hawaii, which came as early as the 1830s and then became more popular from the 1850s. And from these French sources, you can find two very interesting aspects that I've been passionate about. Is first, among the merchants, there were also surgeons and doctors. And these surgeons were concerned with the hygiene movement.
The hygiene movement was something that the doctors were concerned about because of all the epidemics.
Yes, right. So doctors and physicians, they were concerned about the epidemics, such as measles, for instance, we call it cholera in French. And these epidemics were ongoing throughout the 19th century in France, especially in Paris, but also in Hawaii, where many native Hawaiians died of these epidemics, such as smallpox as well. So the doctors and physicians found out that even though they could not always cure the disease, they might prevent it. And they found out that sport activities, especially related ocean-related activities, might be a good way to prevent having some disease. And when this physician came in Hawaii in about the 1830s to the 1870s, they found out that surfing was one of the most healthful ocean-related activity that people can do. And with this hygiene movement, you have also many writers, like poets, French poets, that would come to Hawaii as well. They were the first tourists and visitors, and they romanticize it. they started to romanticize that idea that the Hawaiian were a population of amphibious beings. For instance, Hawaiian women were portrayed as mermaid, or so naiad, or nymphs, and the men were like tritons, mercuries, and so along with hygiene movement, you have a whole romantic literature through for about 50 to 70 years, saying that surfing is a wonderful sport, it is beautiful, and we have never seen anything like it, the Hawaiian are the best of it. While at that time, most history of surfing will tell you that surfing died out because of the missionaries. And you actually find also missionaries who praise surfing. So that's what you learn from the French sources, is these two movements, which were very big in Europe, were brought out to Hawaii as Westerners, like the French, came to Hawaii and tried to see surfing and the Hawaiian through their own point of view, which were in the literature movement, romanticism, and in with physician and doctors, hygiene.
So you basically then went to the Hawaiian language newspapers as a resource, and because those were translated, you were able to access them.
Well, these newspapers, they are not fully translated, partly. But like you said, they were partially translated. And one person who worked on translating these Hawaiian newspapers into English, especially regarding surfing topic, is Keo Nesmith. He's teaching at UH Manoa. He's a very famous Hawaiian teacher. He also teaches Tahitian, for instance. And he translated this newspaper for the former deputy-in-chief of Honolulu, of the fire department, who is John Clark. John Clark wrote a wonderful book about it. And as I studied surfing for my PhD dissertation, I figured that not only I should tap into the archives, but also I should learn Hawaiian. Because I was frustrated to have only a partial picture, and I wanted to have the whole picture, so I started to learn Hawaiian here in Paris through the French Hawaii Association, and also over there in Hawaii, where I ended up taking classes at UH Manoa. Okay.
And so you've been able to then compile your research into a book which is now published in French.
Yes, it is published in French. It's been released a few weeks ago, and I'm already thinking of an English publisher, because most of my readership, or most of the people who might be interested in this story would be Hawaiians, of course, people also living in Hawaii, and mostly English speakers, because research so far has been carried on by English scholars, since Hawaii has biggest tied with the U.S. than any other country now. But I believe that having the French perspective, like I said, with the hygiene and romantic movement, and also by being able to reading Hawaiian sources, you can bring a whole new history. And that's the idea, to rewrite history, not to say that English history is wrong, but to be as close as possible
to be accurate. So then your hope is then to be able to put the English version out on the market.
Yes, exactly. So the first thing to do is to find an English publisher. But I believe that that publisher will want to wait at least for a year to see how the book is working, not only in France, but it is distributed in French-speaking countries, such as Switzerland. For instance, I'll be talking about the book in Switzerland next year. I've been invited for one of their festivals, and also in Canada. So it's not only distributed in France, but Switzerland, Canada, and other countries in Africa. And after a year, you can get an idea of how the book is doing, if it's working well or not. And the idea would be to have a publisher to buy the rights of the book and then translate it, which I hope also to improve that version to a more complete and comprehensive history.
That was Jeremy Lamourier talking about a recent book about the history of surfing in Hawaii that was just published in French. He and others with the French Hawaii Association are working to one day publish the Hawaiian Dictionary in French.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Paddle Sports on Maui, providing sustainable ecotours with a dedication to using business for environmental and social change. HawaiianPaddleSports.com.
It's time to take a look at activities going on around the state that are a little bit under the radar. And our source for that is Morning Edition host and our colleague, Derek Malama. And a couple of interesting things coming up, Derek.
Yes. On Wednesday, you can enjoy Midsummer Nights, Taste of the Bard in downtown Honolulu. Mm-hmm. The Hawaii Shakespeare Festival continues with a staging of All's Well That Ends Well. Shakespeare departs from his traditional formula early on in this play, and then the fun begins in this fairy tale adventure. You can see it tomorrow night at 7:30 in the Arts at Mark's Garage, and it runs through the weekend.
That sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
And you can learn about the ancient practice of Lomi Lomi tomorrow in Hilo.
Kumu Lena Ala Brown will share her knowledge of Hawaiian massage tomorrow from 10 a.m. until noon, and this takes place in the Moku Papapa Discovery Center in downtown Hilo, and this is free.
And there's a film on the Big Island. This is an interesting one about a 70s rock star.
Right. It's the documentary Searching for Sugar Man about 1970s rock star Sixto Rodriguez. And the film won an Academy Award for Best Documentary. Actually, Rodriguez didn't have a great career here in the U.S., but his albums were really successful in South Africa, and he sold more records there than Elvis Presley in South Africa. Searching for Sugarman is rated PG-13, and it screens at 5:30 in the Kealakekua Public Library. This is free, and also free is the popcorn there while supplies last.
Can't go wrong.
No,
enjoy. Find out what this guy had that Elvis didn't have.
I know.
Must add something, right?
Right. You'll
Thanks
find
a
out.
Lot, Derek.
Sure.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, a dramatic look at the silent partner to the Orpheus legend.
Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments and your voice. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
And if you missed any of this show or you want a past one, you can find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkrug.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.